This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with David Swanson, back from the conference in Vermont.
Swanson desperately wants to put Bush in prison. For years, he's wanted to impeach him as well.
In the wake of the biggest capitalist crisis on Wall Street since 1929, we have in the studio both economist Max Fraud Wolf and political scientist John Ehrenberger.
They take on the root of this crisis, as well as what we can expect from the Republicans and the Democrats if and when we get a new government.
Stay with us.
Today, we're again happy to bring our listeners David Swanson, a journalist, formerly worked with Denis Kucinich, and has been deeply involved in the efforts to impeach President Bush and other high-level officials. David recently went to a conference to plan the prosecution of George W. Bush, as well as other officials, members of Congress, as well as federal judges, for war crimes. We're really pleased today to talk to David about what went on at this important conference, which will hopefully lay out a framework for going after high-level officials over the next few years. Well, David, we're really pleased you're here. And I know you were at the conference a few days ago about prosecuting Bush and others for war crimes. Can you just give us a sense of what happened, what it was like for you being there?
It was a terrific conference. It was put together by the Massachusetts School of Law by Dean Lawrence Velville, and it was held at a hotel in Andover, Massachusetts. And it was about 150 people, which was all you could fit in the room. In fact, people had to be turned away.
That's great. Out.
It was an unusual mixture of lawyers and activist lawyers and scholars and plain old activists without law degrees. And there was quite a contingent that was quite strongly still pushing for impeachment. And of course, everyone who wants prosecution wants impeachment, just about, and every single person who's wanted impeachment wants prosecution. But the conference focused on prosecution and on some specific proposals for how we can get there. And I certainly learned a great deal. And I've posted some details and started working on some actions at my website, which is convictbushcheney.org.
Nice.
Well, David, break it down for us. Just how would people in the United States go about getting these war criminals convicted?
Well, one possibility is through state and local prosecutors. There are 50 state attorneys general and about 2,700 district, county-level prosecutors. And many of them are elected, so we can elect prosecutors who want to prosecute Bush and Cheney. And in fact, one of the things that happened at this conference was that Vince Bugliosi, a former prosecutor who's come up with what he thinks is a legal strategy for prosecuting Bush for murder at the state or local level on behalf of Gold Star families and troops who were killed in Iraq, met a woman who is running a serious campaign for attorney general of the state of Vermont.
That's great.
And so this week they are announcing together a proposal in which she will appoint him special prosecutor.
Come on. You're serious? Tell me.
Yeah, he's promised he wanted to do that.
No, but tell me about the Vermont. What they announced?
There are actually, believe it or not, two women running for attorney general of Vermont who want to do this. The one who is most closely working with Vince Bugliosi and was at the conference is named Charlotte Dennett, and she is a member of the Progressive Party, which is a major party in Vermont, which holds seats in the legislature and so forth. And she is holding a press conference with Vince Bugliosi to announce that if elected attorney general, she will appoint him special prosecutor to begin a prosecution of Bush and Cheney for murder on behalf of citizens of Vermont killed in active duty in Vermont, of which Vermont, among the 50 states, has suffered proportionately the worst in casualties in Iraq.
David, is that because of the illegal nature of the war, how the country and the Congress were fooled and tricked by the administration into declaring war against Iraq? And is that the basis for it?
Well, there are statutory crimes involved there, some of which might best be prosecuted at the federal level. But Bugliosi's particular argument is for murder, first-degree murder. And one of the things we developed at this conference was that there is a parallel argument for attempted murder in which you would not need to work with a Gold Star family, but any Iraq War veteran who wanted to work on this. So at convictbushcheney.org, we're lining up charts of where we have prosecutors, where we have candidates for prosecutor, where we have veterans, and where we have Gold Star families who want to work on this. The argument is that Bush knowingly sent U.S. servicemen and women into an action in which at least some of them were guaranteed to be killed. And he did so not in self-defense, and therefore not legally, but on the basis of a false pretense, and therefore illegally. And having done so, he is absolutely as guilty of murder under the law as if he pulled the trigger.
Terrific. That's wonderful. That's an amazing initiative.
So that's one of many, many
initiatives. Tell us a bit more. I know there's that issue, the war issue. There's the torture issue. There's international prosecutions. Was there a lot of discussion of this?
Philippe Sands, who's a Brit, were from overseas and commented that the position taken by this outlandish left-wing conference mentioned in the media only through an attack by the New York Sun is absolutely mainstream in Europe, including England. Philippe Sands' positions are absolutely middle of the road in England. The problem is that foreign countries and the International Criminal Court will be looking at the United States first. And if there is activity here to prosecute, even failed activity to prosecute, if perhaps especially failed activity to prosecute, then foreign prosecutions will become more likely. But if the citizens of the United States are not pushing for impeachment, not pushing for prosecution, there are no prosecutions happening in the United States, then Spain and other countries will be less likely to take it up on their own. So it's something we have to work together with our allies overseas on. And the International Criminal Court is a possibility as well, though there are many hurdles, including U.S. veto power at the United Nations. This was a legal conference dominated by lawyers, and so, of course, there was a lot of interest not just in Bush and Cheney, but in the lawyers and advisors without whom none of these crimes would have been possible.
Well, let's mention a few names. Michael, why don't you do that? You've just written the book.
As you know, David, I wrote a book called The Prosecution of Donald Rumsfeld.
I got it yesterday in the mail.
Good.
I'm dying to read it.
Terrific. Well, it does mention a half a dozen of the lawyers in there, you, Addington, et cetera. And, of course, our position is very clear about they're both ethical violations as well as legal violations. But give us a sense of what was the discussion like at the conference.
Well, there were discussions of how to prosecute those lawyers at federal, state, and local levels, as well as how to get them disbarred in various states in which they have law licenses, and how to deny them tenure at universities. And that was a controversial point because there were those who held up the value of academic freedom over the value of throwing someone like John Yoo out of the University of California.
Yeah, well, that's what the dean at his law school says, that he's got a First Amendment right to advocate that. There's an answer to that, of course. You don't have a right to advocate criminal activity and cover it over and facilitate it. But nonetheless, that's how he's been protected so far.
Well, I agree with you. Someone who has facilitated torture and about whom the evidence is absolutely public knowledge has given up the right to freedom of any sort, much less academic freedom. He belongs behind bars. And so one of the activities some of us are working on involves citizen arrests. We have, again, if you go to convictbushcheney.org, you'll find a kit and how you can conduct a citizen's arrest and updates on where we know that the bad guys are on any given day. And as you may have heard a couple of months ago in Iowa, a judge heard the case of people arrested for having attempted a citizen's arrest of Karl Rove, and the judge was told what they were there for, and he said, well, it's about time.
So, David, you actually sound very excited by what happened at the conference. It's just thrilling to hear you like this.
I am energized by it. I think people should be energized by it. Impeachment doesn't end. Impeachment can and should and must happen even after they're out of office, even after they're dead, because it's about establishing a precedent. But prosecution begins now. It's when they're out of office that prosecution really becomes possible, and the avenues are so wide open because we don't necessarily have to go through Congress, we don't necessarily have to go through the new Justice Department, which will be a very uphill fight whether it's Obama or McCain's. We can go through other countries, we can go through states, we can go through local prosecutors, and so we have to do so, but we also have to keep the fight up in Washington on impeachment and on preventing pardons.
Well, I think preventing pardon is actually crucial. I mean, I understand that, you know, we could still go to Europe if there's a pardon, but the chances if there's of successful prosecution in the U.S. are highly diminished if there's a pardon. So tell me how you're thinking about doing that.
Well, there is an argument that the way the Constitution reads, a pardon only applies to federal prosecution, and that state and local prosecution might still be possible on various charges. There is also, of course, an argument that self-pardon and pardon of subordinates acting on your orders is unconstitutional. There is even an argument, although there are court rulings and precedents against it, that any preemptive pardon is unconstitutional. I think we need to be pushing Congress members now and the presidential campaigns now to take positions, to introduce legislation, even constitutional amendments, and to threaten impeachment over this issue. I mean, we have to establish, and those who follow original intent, so it would be thrilling to get this to the Supreme Court, have to recognize that the mere idea of a preemptive pardon or a pardon of yourself or your subordinates is outrageously unconstitutional. So we have to address this, because once it's done and accepted, it becomes law, and no matter how absurd, just as signing statements now have.
David, it does sound, I mean, the excitement is terrific, and I'm interested, you did say your website once, but if listeners want to get involved in everything from impeachment to prosecution to preventing a pardon, you said you're going to post a bunch of issues on it.
There has been a website about the conference, which I think I'm remembering correctly as war-crimes.info. There is a committee that's been set up with conference calls planned and organizing underway coming out of the conference, and so there may be any number of websites and resources created. But my website is convictbushcheney.org. You can also get there through afterdowningstreet.org, and I have links to the complete video of the conference for those who want to watch it.
This is wonderful. David, thank you very much for really, not just for this interview, but for being on top of this issue for a very long time and for running some amazing websites as well.
David Swanson, great to have you on Law & Disorder.
Well, same to all of you. Thank you.
Thanks,
very
David.
Much.
Last week, with the collapse of several major brokerage houses on Wall Street and the federal government taking over the mortgage industry, will probably go down as one of the major crises in the capitalist economy since 1929. Today we have both Max Frodwolf, an economist who teaches at the New School and writes for the Huffington Post, and John Ehrenberg, author of Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice, who teaches political science at Long Island University, in an extraordinary discussion. Max Frodwolf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you both for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, is it the year 2008 or is it the year 1929?
A little bit of both, maybe. A little bit of 1929 and 2008 form. They didn't have the infrastructure technologically or telecommunicatively to go this fast and lose money at the speed that we can today. So yeah, I guess it's even faster. And that's both a good thing and a bad thing, I suppose. It was a good thing when you could make money faster, and it's a little bit less desirable now that you can lose it at the speed of light or the click of a button. So yeah, it's pretty brutal out there. It seems to get worse and worse. And the pattern of behind closed doors, cloak and dagger regulatory intervention, where Sunday afternoon hosts regulators and captain of industries huddled in a corner with no accountability, making life and death decisions for whole firms and their thousands of employees, doesn't do a lot in my mind to calm my nerves. And it appears I'm not alone as we sit and chat and the Dow tanks yet again.
Well, they're using the term class war again, where the government, that is our tax money, is going to bail out AIG, the biggest insurance company in the world. On the other hand, they're not bailing out the thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who are about to lose their homes. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I think it's unfortunate. I think a lot of what's been done here is a huge effort to do two things, both of which I would liken in their wisdom to urinating into a turned-on fan. And I think they're going to have more or less the same dramatic result, the wet shoes, wet pants, and a big frown. And that is, this is an enormous regulatory and governmental effort to keep house prices up, and they have to fall, and they will fall, and to keep massive credit flowing to the American middle class to keep them borrowing, and they can't afford the debt they already took, and nobody in their right mind is going to loan that much more to them. So it's trying to go back to an unsustainable situation, which is over. I mean, one of the only rules of financial strategy that I know to not be wrong almost half the time is that when a bubble bursts, the next bubble is never in the same place. i.e. once people learn that this isn't a sure win, always great, genius idea that will make you money, it takes them a long time to forget the pain and the fallout. And so you can't reinflate an old bubble. If you want to do the whole bubble economy thing, and we apparently do, you at least need a new bubble. You cannot go back into the old bubble. And I think a lot of what we're trying to do is spend money and send reassurance signals to the public that we can reinflate the old bubble, and we just can't.
We as the government.
Yeah, we as the government, and to some extent, whatever help and assistance and credit is given by the relatively stronger going concerns to the relatively weaker going concerns. So yeah, but you're largely right. We is the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury. And I would mention that the AIG, the biggest story not being told today and the scariest piece of news I got today on a scary day, and I'm a man who's used to being scared, and if nothing changed that, the last few weeks would have, that the Federal Reserve's bailout of AIG was big enough to require the Federal Reserve to go to the U.S. Treasury to sell more treasuries, to give the money to the Federal Reserve so its books would be in okay shape after it bailed out AIG. That is not –
in other words, they're running out of money is your point.
Their books needed to pick me up from the Treasury over at the Fed this morning, and they got it. And I'm sure that will work out. In other words, it'll be a well-done operation and all the rest of it. But that is a really unsettling fun fact for the day. Right?
So somebody's buying these treasuries.
Somebody's buying the treasuries.
And of course, as people are scared, they're buying treasuries, so they have no problem selling treasuries right now.
And treasuries treasuries are bid up, and a lot of people are running into treasuries, and that'll last until people realize that they're running out of the frying pan on some level and into the fire. I would be nervous the long-term mega treasury holdings, because the U.S. government's books make Lehman Brothers' books look good at this point.
And yeah, but if you own debt guaranteed by the government, we always used to joke, you know, that the only thing that will ruin this would be a revolution.
Sure.
So what's wrong with owning treasuries?
Well, what's wrong with owning treasuries if you're not going to own them to maturity? If they're a speculative investment, a trade, as opposed to a long-term investment, right, then you're running into a very expensive asset whose underlying books and health, the U.S. government, is not looking so great. So if you're not planning to hold for the whole long haul, you're going to pay a lot of money to get into those treasuries. And if you need, want, or have to, and for investors it could be maybe they can hold it, but for a speculator they might have to get out of it to raise money, you may be getting out of this instrument at a much lower price than you got in. In addition to which, they're trading at a premium. So if you hold them to maturity, you may have bought it for $110, you'll get back $100, and they're so expensive that they're going to give you a yield that's less than half the rate of inflation. So you are locking in risk if you sell early and guaranteed loss if you hold to maturity.
So all these private citizens that are out there and all the people who have government pensions and all, say, working class people, middle class people, there's nowhere to hide. There's nowhere to run. There's nowhere to go.
Investment-wise, there's no sure place to run and hide. That's true.
So what's going to happen? We're talking to you at the moment in which they brought out Fannie Mae. The feds have bought out or supported Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, AIG. Who else? What else is out there? Merrill Lynch.
The federal government presided over a shotgun wedding between Merrill Lynch and Bank of America.
Right. So
in the new classic way that the federal government here auctions off companies. They invite one bidder. Right. I mean, I'm no expert on auctions, right, but when you watch them on TV and they auction off cattle, there's never one guy in the audience.
Right.
And my understanding of that from years of economics courses is when you want top price for an asset, it's prudent to invite multiple bidders. Sotheby's seems to have figured this out, and Butterfield's and all the rest of them. So I'm not quite sure why the government likes these one-bidder auctions. It's a little bit odd. But yeah, so we saw Bear Stearns get taken behind the barn by the regulators, shot in the head, and its corpse was fed to J.P. Morgan, which everyone calls the Bear Stearns bailout. But I mean, I'm lucky no one's bailed me out that way, because that's not the way I'd want to be bailed out. We saw Lehman driven under while the feds had a meeting purporting to look for a solution, burned out the clock, killed it so they could announce that they weren't bailing everyone. And then we're right back in the bailout business 24 hours later to the tune of $85 billion.
So you suspect we're going to see more bailouts of sorts?
Well, Washington Mutual is already bankrupt. For some reason, no one's talking about it, and the Fed is shopping them around today.
That's the largest savings and loan outfit in the United States. AIG was the largest insurance company in the United States, really a worldwide outfit with
sure, that's part of the reason
Walmart does countries.
Washington Mutual or WaMu doesn't get as much attention, which is also an interesting change because it's not an international company so much. And these more international companies get a lot of attention from the federal government regulators, the Treasury and the Fed, because we need to keep foreigners loaning us money. And the reason September 7th was the date of demise in their former incarnations for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was because foreign central banks began selling very rapidly the mortgage-backed securities. And to reassure them, the government said, okay, we'll make you whole with taxpayer money if need be.
Wow.
Don't desert the ship here. And that's why you saw Sunday, September 7th become the sort of day of reckoning for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Again, though, we don't know how much these are going to cost because the Fannie Mae Freddie Mac deal and the AIG deal, which by the way is a carbon copy of the Fannie Mae Freddie Mac deal largely, are open-ended. So they pledge initial money and open for much greater. So we know where those two deals put us instantaneously on the hook for $285 billion, but they could have bigger impact and ramification, as could the Fed decision which came out with the BOA Merrill Lynch buyout news that investment banks, well, the two left and one circling the, you know, the bowl as we speak, can do all kinds – you can drop off all kinds of basically potentially risky securities at the Federal Reserve and borrow money against them, which means the Federal Reserve could take major losses on its books if somebody who's dropped off a lot of securities, which are declining in asset price, then goes under and tells the Fed, yeah, well, you get to keep what we dropped off because we ain't coming back for it.
It's really extraordinary. Let's put this in class terms. We're talking to Max Frodwolf. He's on our side, not theirs. If you and your colleagues who are on our side were going to make the policy now as to what to do, what would you say should be done?
Okay. Firstly, the whole response to the debt meltdown centered in real estate, I think missed the boat on a few important areas. I would mention that once you're in this situation, anything you do is fraught with risk. There are good ideas and smart people hard at work in the Fed and the Treasury, so they're not all criminals and hucksters and, you know, nothing of the sort. But I think that the mistake that was made is there should have been an emphasis on trying to guard the capital, not the yields. So they should have come in and basically canceled the interest portion of the mortgage repayments. Let people pay only the principal they borrow. Put off the interest payments to the back end of the loan, 20 years out, 30 years out, and say, let's give you some skin in the game, some reason to keep the house.
Because what really happened here is when they had the mortgages and the interest rates started to go up, right? So
right.
They got killed. People
so they're
pay.
Paying all interest.
That's a very interesting suggestion.
No matter how much they pay, right. They get nothing. You know, offering the general public nothing sometimes makes the general public mad. People got cocky offering the public nothing because they offered the public nothing to great applause for 25 years. And, you know, you can get stuck in your ways. But the idea being that people should be able to see whatever payment they make increase their ownership on the house.
Reduce the mortgage and increase
reduce
their
the actual the
so this is a good idea. This would keep people's
idea.
Homes.
I think – well,
so
I
why didn't they do that?
Well, because that immediately causes all these asset yields to drop to zero. Right.
They're made into securities and all these banks own all these.
Sure. But you slam the people who took the more speculative high yield portion because they're buying the only interest payments.
Right.
Zero. These are the very rich. So idea number one.
Or institutions.
Let people off the hook on the interest who bought these homes so they can keep their homes. What's idea number two?
When that would probably fail, which I'll admit, okay, that might not be enough for a lot of people, then I think the federal, state, and local governments should seize the house and rent them back to the occupants. They should get themselves into the housing business. They just took 25 years off from the affordable housing business. We have crisis level.
What do you mean they took 25
years? We haven't built much in the way of affordable housing in this country in 25 years, which is part of the reason we have desperate people overpaying for a house and getting a mortgage they can't take over. So I think they should have seized some of the houses, become the landlord, rented them back. And I think they should have done a hodgepodge designed to keep people solvent, the general public, and keep them in their homes, as opposed to trying to rescue the value of the assets that this home mortgage bonanza created. And ultimately, and this isn't, of course, the target, this would have been better for the asset holders as well, particularly the more reasonable asset holders. And I would caution anyone, you got to be careful here. Not all people who own assets are, you know, tycoons. It's also the Red Cross, which is now on the edge of bankruptcy. And it's also a university endowment that puts kids through college on a scholarship that's running out of money. And it's also the local charitable organization that does good deeds in the community, or the soup kitchen, or, you know, there's a lot of people living off assets who are not the sort of, you know, Gordon Gekko of Wall Street tycoon types.
Let me just switch focus here with you, Max. It seems to me that instead of over the last, say, quarter of a century, there being a lot of money put into productive assets to make more things for people who need more things, you know, like decent food or decent housing, energy-efficient cars and so on, it seems to me that capital was going into speculative areas, you know, like these bundles of mortgages. Why is that?
Well, I mean, capital, theoretically, well-advised and nimble capital, and the deregulation movement we had has made capital more footloose. I mean, it can really move between sectors and countries at a speed, at a rate, and to an extent that is we haven't seen since World War I, probably, era. So a very deregulatory environment. But capital looked for the highest returns it could find. I think it did a lot more productive investment, but it did a lot of it outside the United States. The United States came to specialize in financing things, making movies, making weapons, and buying whatever junk transnational companies made somewhere else cheap. We became a consumer debt plantation. And the new debt that we need to keep being a consumer debt plantation is now called into question. But that means the global economy is called into question. And my guess is that the next two or three acts in this drama will involve the pain exiting. It will not be so centered in the financial sector, and it will not be so centered in America. The shockwaves of this explosion are going to slam into the developing world with a vengeance. Because if Americans can't buy that stuff and American companies can't finance its production, its shipment, and its eventual sale, then they don't need 400,000 people making strawberry shortcake underpants on the southeast coast of China. And they don't need all the call centers in India. And they don't need some 8-year-old sewing the soccer ball for them in Pakistan. So, I mean, the whole situation is going to change. And you can see the ultimate sort of too big to fail – the story given to us about Fannie and Freddie and AIG, the ultimate example of too big to fail is the United States of America. Everybody else has a problem too, right? If we go down, we will create a whirlpool undertow that will suck a lot of the rest of the global elite and the global economy with it. So I think this is going to offshore itself, this crisis, in the next 8 months to 12 months probably in a dramatic sense. And people will get an idea of the sad truth that poop rolls downhill and that this is not localized to Wall Street, to finance, or to the United States.
And how would you assess the various responsibility as between the Republicans and the Democrats in the direction the economy has been going in the last quarter century?
I mean, it's hard to let anyone off the hook. Unfortunately, there's more than enough blame to go around. And the Democratic Party has not been particularly astute or interventionist or interested in slowing this operation. When you're apportioning blame, I would put it this way. The Democratic Party has been slower in saying yes to whatever it was asked than the Republican Party, which has occasionally sought to distinguish itself by saying yes to things that industry hadn't even asked for yet and sometimes didn't even want. So it's hard to, you know, describe one and the other as different, although individuals in both the parties, more the Democratic Party, but there are individuals who did yeoman work, fought against this stuff, and really deserve more credit than they've gotten in a long time. So there are individuals who really do deserve a lot of appreciation and exoneration, since many of them have been slammed in reports and mass media for a long time. And they've been slammed for proposing and for suggesting we do things that would have, in retrospect, saved us a heck of a lot of loss and pain at this point.
Going forward, how do you see the next couple of years? Do you see will there be increases in taxes in the United States to pay for all this? Do you see us getting toward the end of this?
I think that this is going to go on for quite a bit longer time-wise, so I don't think that we're at the end of the process, but I think the process will change. It will leave being centered in finance and centered around financial firms, and it'll ripple out into the macro economy. And we're already seeing some of that because, you know, part of what we were doing in lockstep with writing way too much debt and trading too much debt was building an absolutely cataclysmic overhang of retail space. And we have an unbelievable number of our citizens toiling at the not too terribly room for advancement type jobs you get in the way too numerous and way too large malls set up to allow 4.5% of the world's population to do about 25% of the world's private consumption, which we've been doing. And that will not continue. And that will send shockwaves into other areas of the economy, which I think will be major. And it'll have a major effect on the people around the world who loaned us the money, and that's a global business, and the people around the world who are making and selling XYZ to the US. And I think that there's a very significant risk that around the world, countries and policies become more protectionist and more nationalist as it becomes a beggar thy neighbor game to deal with the economic downturn. So I think the free trade momentum, which was largely killed by the Bush administration's militarism, will take another body blow in a global recession here. And I'm not so clear how that sifts itself out.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Max Frodwolf, economist from the New School here in New York, and John Ehrenberg, the political scientist at Long Island University. John Ehrenberg, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we're certainly living in extraordinary times with what's happening on Wall Street, with the right-wing populist Republican Party trying to tap into that discontent. I think people are feeling very uneasy, and we're glad to have you down at the studio and really wanted to get your take on what's recently happened, where we are and where you think we're going. Max Frodwolf is here from the point of view of an economist.
Which is always good to have, somebody who actually knows something.
You can ask him for a short-term loan.
look, my sense of this is, I've been thinking about it on the way down, my sense of this is that the economic troubles is really the direct villain here is the Bush tax cuts and this general ideology of low taxation and this notion somehow that if you convince Americans that they should not pay taxes, but you've got a government that has to borrow money. What you've got is a tremendous infusion of capital from the world into the country, and that capital has to find a place. And capital, being what it is, gets repackaged and reorganized and redone. And that's, I think, I mean, Max may disagree, but I think that's really what's behind the this frenzy of irresponsible borrowing and lending that's driven us into this mess. I think you've got a classic Marxian problem here of the necessity to destroy enormous amounts of capital, and that's what's been going on for the last couple of days.
Necessity to what?
To destroy enormous amounts of unproductive capital, and that's what's been going on. There's just two.
Explain that a little more.
Well, as long as you've got a government that tells the American people that you can spend and spend and spend and borrow and borrow and borrow and consume and consume and consume without raising your taxes, and that you're going to drive the country into deficit, but the country's productive enough to overcome that through its sheer size and kind of battering power, you're going to have a situation where there are a lot of lenders around who have a lot of money that's been coming in from outside lenders who are buying up treasury certificates, and that capital has got to be spent. It can't sit still. And I think that's what's behind the haste and the willingness and the ease with which these bankers for years and years and now have been packaging these esoteric instruments and selling them to people, frankly, who they shouldn't have been selling them to. And I think that's what's gotten us into this mess. In that sense, it's really a classical Marxian problem of oversupply.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
I still need more explanation.
Well, maybe the economist can put this in terms more technical terms.
Well, it depends. I think the Bush tax cuts threw gasoline on a fire, And I think that fire is related to basically the fact that there's been limited or negative some years and slight shallow positive some years wage growth for the majority of Americans. Meanwhile, the productive capacity of global enterprise has skyrocketed, and the way to make money is to find a way to produce something with very low wages. This creates a classic problem of insufficient aggregate demand.
Right.
In other words, we can make it cheap, we can even find this nice young 11-year-old here in the rainforest to work in the factory for a whopping 39 cents an hour, but all of that comes to naught if you can't find someone somewhere who will buy it. No matter how cheap and how efficiently and how far-flung and how well-engineered it is, if it doesn't sell, you go under. So there's a problem. You're trying to keep the wages down to make more profit, but you've got to run massive-scale production to be profitable. Then you have the problem, who the hell can afford to buy all this stuff? The answer is loosely nobody on some level, because you're redistributing wealth up through tax cuts and through shifting the portion going to wages versus the portion going to profits. So your success breeds a nightmare. The nightmare is resolved by international financial markets and growing indebtedness from the state, which is kind of a last-ditch outlet dumpster to sell stuff to, and to the public who wants the stuff all over the world. And Americans aren't unique in using borrowed money to buy things. What made Americans unique, if anything, is people would loan them more. That's probably over, but that used to be true. And the way this was solved was loan them what you didn't pay them in wages and get them to buy. And to some extent, loan them what you didn't pay someone else in wages so they could buy too. 4.5% of the world's population resides in the United States. 25% of the world's consumption almost is done here. So there's a bit of a mismatch. We specialize in consuming. Somebody else specializes in producing. And all of this requires increasingly intricate, increasingly involved, and increasingly risky financing, because you're financing something that literally cannot go on forever. And stuff that cannot go on forever doesn't. And this isn't going on the way it was, right?
Yep.
The government jumps into the mix, picks up excess spending, and does certain kinds of spending, and it too does it with borrowed money. And the government does everything with borrowed money because there's endlessly more demands on the government. Because the irony of our age of small government is we need more and more from those governments still functioning. And so they spend more and more, and there's no way around it, and they don't tax it. So you're constantly redistributing wealth up. And that also creates a lot of money chasing assets. Redistributing money up creates more money chasing assets, which creates larger possible bubbles, just as you need to have more money out there to finance an increasingly perilous imbalance. And this goes on until it doesn't. And the real fear ripping through the world right now is that it doesn't anymore. And that means the architecture of the global production and spend economy, the way we've erected it, is got some very serious problems in its structural beam and support system.
Now, is that different than what you said?
Yeah, No, it's the same thing.
So put that together for us, John.
All right. The ideological piece of this is absolutely correct, that you've got a period of wage stagnation where people basically can't afford to buy what they produce, and a period where ideologically the possibilities of actually politicians going to the American people and saying, look, we have got to raise taxes and we're going to raise everybody's taxes by 20%, that's impossible. So you've got this kind of classic problem where the political apparatus at the moment is absolutely paralyzed from doing what has to be done. And you've got this spinning ideology of high consumption, wage stagnation, borrowed money, increasing indebtedness. The bubble keeps on expanding until finally, you know, it can't anymore. I mean, I think that's absolutely what's been going on.
Now, why can't they raise taxes? You say they just can't go to the American people. And they need to raise taxes because of the debt, I presume, is what you're saying.
We can't go on like this. You can't. I mean, it's true. You cannot go on pretending as if you can borrow your way out of these contradictions. You just can't do it. All it does is it throws oil in the fire, or it just intensifies the nature of the contradiction. So at some point, if Americans want stuff from the state, which they do, they can no longer pretend that they can have stuff from the state at the same time having the lowest rate of taxation of anybody in the advanced industrial world. It just doesn't work that way. At the end of the day, though, the conversation that we have got to have in this country is the old conversation about Keynesianism. And it's true. The only way to actually put this on some kind of rational basis upon which we can base our discussions is, how are we going to stimulate aggregate demand here at home? How are we going to redistribute income? Look, the question
– the real question, if I'm trying to understand, is you're trying to say you want to have a consuming – not have, but we have that – And we don't want to do it through debt. We want to do it through actually wage increases.
That's
essentially,
right.
if I'm
that's
taking
right.
it as a very
that's
simple.
Right.
Say
right.
it in
yeah.
how you want to. But
that's the basis of Keynesianism. And Keynesianism is ideologically predisposed to a certain measure of wealth, of wealth equality and of redistribution. That will run against 25 years of the contemporary political history in this country. But it's, you know, just as the right rose to power by claiming that Keynesianism could no longer deal with stagflation, so the opening now exists for the left to begin to make the claim that it's now time for old-fashioned Keynesian stimulus because it can no longer deal with the consequences of these bubbles exploding all the time.
And how would you do that? Let's give me some examples of that.
Well, look, if I were, you know, if I were a Democratic candidate for president,
right.
You know, I'd be talking about, and Obama, to his credit, he is a little bit talking about this. He's talking about higher taxes and redistributed social policies. So he's talking about taxing people who make $280,000 or more. He's talking about tax breaks for the lower elements of society so they can consume more. He's talking about infrastructure. He's talking about job retraining. All the stuff that Obama actually is talking about are a reinvigorated model of social spending. Now, he hasn't yet come out flat out and said, look, we have got to rethink our position about the role of the state in contemporary society. We've got to rethink our position about taxes. He probably can't in the current environment. So what you've got with the Obama campaign is kind of a soft intimation of a revival of Keynesian economics and of politics as well, without actually naming it. And probably given everything that's been going on in this country for 25 years, that's as good as you can expect at the moment.
If you had your druthers, rather than just something that's as good as you can expect, what would you want?
Well, I think that the only way any of this is going to happen is with powerful social movements that exert pressure on Congress and on the parties from outside. I mean, I think that's the law of American politics. If I had my way, we'd be talking about single-payer health insurance. We'd be talking about a fully socialized system of delivering health care. You know, we all have our laundry list of this.
I'd like to hear it.
Well, I'd be talking about utter transparency in every single political process that goes on. I'd be talking about publicly funded elections. There's a whole laundry list of things that I have.
What would you do for unemployment?
Well, you know, all kinds of public spending is what's necessary. I mean, Obama's right. Look, the country's infrastructure has been deliberately neglected for the better part of a generation now, whether it's bridges in Minnesota or levees in New Orleans, or just take a look around this city. I mean, so there are tens of billions of dollars of public spending that would generate jobs, that would generate demand, put money in people's pockets, and at the same time address these infrastructural concerns. That's a good way to start. That's FDR. You know, that's the CCC.
What would you do about trade unions?
I would pass all kinds of legislation making it easier, including the Freedom of Choice Act. I mean, I would pass all kinds of legislation making it easier to organize trade unions. I would certainly punish employers for illegal activity when they fire workers and otherwise get in the way of union drives. There's a whole panoply. You know, there were people saying that the old industrial politics of the left, organized around the working class, were over and done with. This is the basis of Bill Clinton's third way. You know, the country is no longer an industrial country. Therefore, since people aren't engaged in industry anymore, they don't think like industrial workers, and the politics of progressivism these days have to be organized around lifestyle and autonomy and freedom of choice. And here all of a sudden we are in the year 2008 in a so-called post-industrial economy. And where we've come to is that the stimulus measures that are necessary and the public spending measures that are necessary and the encouragement to trade union organizations that are absolutely essential, all of this is the New Deal writ large. It is time to rethink a new deal in this country, and that requires an active public sector with active state activity and active stimulation of domestic demand and putting money in people's pockets. It's, you know, this is old stuff. Is this socialism? No. But is it far better than what we're going to get? Absolutely. And that's what people ought to be talking about. And frankly, I think that politically and ideologically, things are shifting enough and the shift is dramatic enough these days that it's going to be possible to put these questions on the table in the not too distant future.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think two things are happening at once. It'd be possible to put these questions on the table, but I think also the right-wing ideologues are going to put other questions on the table. And there's real confrontations brewing in this terrible situation. Just as, for example, those confrontations brewed in Germany when their economy went into the tank.
Yeah, the history of a lot of this. I mean, this does follow an old pattern. The pattern is for periods of capitalist reorganization presided over by the Republican Party with the Democrats as the junior partner. at some point, the country gets run into a ditch, right? Whether it's the 1920s or whether, right? Yeah. And that's what's happening now. And the Democrats step forward as the party of reform and the party of to limit the excesses and get things back on track. And that's what you see developing now. Now, it may be a couple of election cycles before this really takes shape.
Right. Last time we interviewed you, of course, we weren't in as big a ditch. You saw it there, but you weren't as big a ditch.
And here we are.
And here we are, and we have...
There is going to be a debate between the free marketeers and the supply-siders who have been running the country for the last 25 years, but who are manifestly and demonstrably incapable of doing so in the future. So
yeah, I think it's going to be a debate if it's between the Republicans and the Democrats on this question. Everybody's going to be on one side of the table. Obama and his advisors from the Chicago School say, we're for the free market also. So where's the debate going to come from?
Well, I think Obama is a free marketer. He describes himself as more respectful of markets than Democrats have been in the past. There's a very good piece about his economic stuff, by the way, about 2 or 3 weeks ago in the Times Magazine section. But these are all basically Clinton people. He does have Jared Bernstein and some pro-labor types to whom he listens. But basically what you get from Obama is warmed over Clintonism.
That's right. True. That's right? Exactly right.
It's still the case that Obama, I think, is smart enough to recognize the need for the downward redistribution of wealth. And look, 25 years later, this is Bolshevism. I mean, this is, you know, you got to take what you got. And we don't have a whole hell of a lot, but believe me, it's a lot better than what we've had. And I think what all of this means is that even as we should keep our powder dry about Obama, he's going to make possible a set of openings and a set of debates and discussions that have not been present on the national scene for a generation. And this is not the end of the road. This is not the socialist salvation of the country. This is the creation of an opening for organization, for social movements, for debate and for discussion, and for actual ideological struggle, which we haven't had for a long time.
I have a less positive set of assumptions about an Obama administration. His economic advisors are pretty much as far right free market types as you can get. The sort of big two would be Goolsbee, who was considered more or less in the field to be a bit of a fringe free marketeer at the University of Chicago Business School, so not a classic Keynesian by any stretch. He would probably have heart palpitations if he were described as such, and those who know him would probably be befuddled. Mr. Furman, despite having an interesting and varied past work experience, seems to have spent a lot of the recent years as the free trade advocate for Walmart, which isn't the standard kind of Keynesian credentialing. I do think that whoever gets elected is going to be much more open to and much more Keynesian in their policy approach package than anything we've seen probably in some time.
So that's really for the reasons that...
because there's not a whole hell of a lot of choice.
There's no alternative here.
Exactly. Right? I mean, there's probably not going to be a whole heck of a lot
when you
of choice.
Say, when you guys, I just want to, for our audience, when you guys both say Keynesian, I know John described it as a sort of consumer society that can afford, has enough wages and equality to be able to buy goods, essentially.
You need to have – it's basically mass – the Fordism is mass production for mass consumption associated with Henry Ford.
Right.
And there's nothing particularly progressive about it because Henry Ford was also a close friend and traveling companion of Hitler's and not usually associated with the far left.
Right.
But his idea was if he wanted to make cars profitably, he had to make a lot of cars and he had to have somebody out there who'd buy a lot of cars. And the answer to the question was figure out a way to extract so much value from your workers that you could afford to give them enough to buy what you produced.
Right.
It doesn't have to be progressive. And, you know, what I think is that you've cornered a too-big-to-fail giant with a limited number of options and half the world's military capability. I wouldn't want to be the guy who corners the gigantic, muscle-bound methamphetamine addict in the corner of the club to throw him out. You know, it just seems like a not altogether sweet gig.
That's why, in many ways, that's why this is a very dangerous moment also.
Yeah, why don't you talk about that? Because I think you're referring to that.
Yeah, I mean, there's the best thing that I think can come of this is a reinvigorated debate about social welfare and the role of the state and the example of the Northern European social democracies. That's the best we're going to get. But at the same time, the Palin phenomenon is the dark underside of this and equally dangerous as the other is, you know, potentially, let's say, interesting. There are multiple resentments and fears and prejudices out there that the McCain campaign has consciously and deliberately decided to embrace and to run on. Now, the whole fantasy of the Obama campaign was that we're over all that this is a post-racial post-60s, post-80s generation, and we can have a different kind of conversation. I don't think anybody knows how this election is going to go. But to the extent that the McCain campaign is making a new culture war out of this thing, to the extent that it has decided that it's going to want a campaign based upon narratives about personal stories and the presentations of families and the reinvocation of the old culture wars of the 80s, if they succeed in that, and they may, if they succeed in that, then truly, then you do have the attic who's cornered. So I think this debate turns out to be, and this election turns out to be, a really critical election for reasons we couldn't have predicted 3 months ago. That's how fast things are changing. So it is true that periods of economic crisis bring forward possibilities for a progressive breaking of the ice, but they also bring forward its opposite. And nowhere is that more obvious than in the way in which the McCain campaign has reconfigured itself over the last week and a half. How it's going to play out, we'll see.
You know, John, that's exactly, you know, I remember when Palin was nominated, Michael and I was talking, I actually saw, not in the sophisticated way you and Max are talking, but that I saw what she represents to America is the myths of America, the frontier, the so-called independence, the not need of the state, all the God stuff, the whole
right,
business.
Right.
And to the extent that they put that back into office, that's pretty serious.
That's right.
It's playing. But and sitting here in New York, I just don't know how America is thinking about those kind of that's really myths about America. At this
the thing
point.
That the thing that even more than that, the thing that you see is this sneering, contemptuous disdain for serious thought, for consideration, for deliberation. I mean, if you looked at, and I, you know, it's not good for my health, so I looked at these people only a little bit, but between her speech and Giuliani's speech, there was this faux populism that comes out, where you have this preposterous vision of a party who, for the last 25 years, has made its business to reward capital and to punish labor, and yet coming forward as a party of the common man. Will this play out? We'll see.
John, I watched with my wife, Debbie, the entire Republican convention, unlike you.
How did you
survive? I don't know where I got the stomach for it, but I watched it. And I had the same reaction you did. And I remember that French term, resentment or resentiment, which was the way the political scientists described petty bourgeoisie, the kind of like the lower middle class in France, who were the core of the fascist tendency in France. And Palin had that stench of that about her.
Yeah.
I had the same reaction you did.
Yeah. Nixon is still this great book, Nixon Land, which I've started. It's
just started
it's
also.
Fabulous
yeah.
book.
It's a thousand
it's great
pages.
Book. Thousand pages, big, thick book.
It's very detailed.
But Nixon was the first, and partly because that's where he came from, Nixon was the first to recognize the potential for mining petty bourgeois resentment, fear, and frustration. That mostly he directed downward. He didn't, you know, petty bourgeois fear and resentment can go down or can go up depending on who you are and right. what your appeal is. Nixon asked the beleaguered, frightened, insecure petty bourgeoisie to look down and to blame its frustrations and its resentments on those below them in the social ladder. And that's the typical way in which fascist mass movements begin to develop. That can happen here. Now, look, I was in Boston when the Palin thing at the American Political Science meeting. So I was around a couple of thousand of professional, you know, my fellow professional social scientists. And the first reaction that people had when the news came that the plane was coming to Dayton, Ohio, bearing the governor of Arkansas is
Governor Alaska, you mean.
Governor Alaska, right. Huh? Who is? Are these people crazy? And who nobody heard of and nobody knew about. For the first day, we were all trying to figure this out. And finally, it really became clear that this is just classic Karl Rove.
Yeah.
This is go to the base, go to the base, go to the base.
Yeah.
And this has been Karl Rove's strategy for as long as he's been around. They can't win with just this.
But they have to get this to win. That's
precisely.
Really right.
So the whole Rove trip is the country is evenly divided. And what the Republicans have to do to win is consolidate the base first and then pick off enough elements of the Democratic constituency to carry them over
the top. They need 15% of the Democrats and 55% of the independents,
right.
they figure, and that'll put them in.
That's right. Now, the flip side of this strategy, and this strategy was endorsed by the Clintons years and years. This is where the whole claim is if the electorate is evenly divided, then you go after the undecided elements of the electorate. Okay. Ask yourselves, after 8 years of this, who can possibly be undecided at this point?
Well,
and the answer is that some people are. Generally speaking, political scientists say, and it's true, that undecided voters are generally the most ignorant about public affairs, the least interested in politics, generally speaking, and the most demobilized elements of the population.
Fascinating. Yeah.
Now, as long as you are – so that registered voters who are committed are tend to be more political and more involved and more informed. If you're – if you buy that – the basic Rovian strategy, this is also the strategy of Clinton's third way. That is to say, the country is divided. You go to the middle and you triangulate like mad. There's been this long debate in the Democratic Party about how to react to situations like this. And way back in the 1980s, Jesse Jackson had an alternative model. And the alternative model was you don't go rushing toward the center. You expand the base with a voter registration campaign, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the problem with expanding the base is as you appeal to Democratic voters who are not registered, you're going to find that they have a pretty radical set of demands.
Yeah.
Right? And those demands have to be addressed.
Yeah.
They have to be. So the risk for Democratic Party operatives, this comes out of the McGovern thing, and it comes out of all the rules that they adopted in the middle 1970s to prevent a recurrence of the so-called activists taking over the Democratic Party. The risk is that you have the Democratic Party apparatus that on some levels would rather lose than to accommodate the desires and the demands of those who are unregistered.
That's precisely right. In Florida, where the election was stolen from him, Jesse Jackson said, come on, let's have a demonstration and protest this.
And Gore said
no. And the tops of the Democratic Party, including Gore, said no.
Absolutely.
They don't want to mobilize these people because they don't know where it's going to go. They do know where it's going to go, yeah. And they don't want to go
And
in
it's
there.
Dangerous. Now, to his credit, and again, we will see what happens on Election Day because this is all in the so-called ground game. To their momentary credit, the Obama people say they understand this. And they say that they are organizing a historic campaign to expand the number of eligible voters, to get them registered, and to make sure that they get to the polls on Election Day. Now, the proof of this will be in the pudding. On some levels, it's just like the debate about Keynesianism being put on the table despite everybody. This is what Obama has to do to win. He's got to do this. If he wants to win, he is going to have to do that which he probably doesn't want to do, and that which certainly the Clinton people in the party have long since resisted. Whether he does it, whether the objective circumstances force him to embrace a more radical organizing strategy on Election Day remains to be seen.
But his position so far is just the opposite. He's rushed over to the center the last 6 weeks with staggering speed. People are shaking their heads.
Position-wise, that's true, but mass organizing has been part of the Obama campaign.
Yeah.
And why I think he has a chance was because of that.
He's going to win because he has the money and enough people are desperately hopeful enough to believe he's actually going to change something. He's got both. He's going to get the grassroots kids who are crying and wearing the T-shirt and banging on doors as well as the $400 million.
That's right.
And that's a pretty good combo. And at least a third of the Republican Party wants him to win anyway. Because if you do keep getting free trade momentum – If you're going to bet the outcome now, you bet it for him.
It's been a really great discussion, guys.
Thank you guys for coming down
and being on Law and Disorder. Good to see you, John. Good to see you, Max.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.